Hey, this is the Meat Eater Podcast, recording out of Bozeman, Montana, hometown of our guest, Randy Newberg, who's been hosting hunting TV programs for a long time.
A while.
How long?
Well, I think, as my grandpa would say, Moby Dick was a minnow back when I started. Actually, it's weird to say, Steve, but I'm going into year 8.
Oh, okay. This year.
So that's, I'm not like Methuselah, but I guess you could say been there, done that.
8 years is a long time. 8 years is a long time to do anything.
It is, especially I just turned 50, and well, I'm going to be 51 in November. And you know, I do these backpack hunts mostly, and I'm like, I don't think I'm going to live long enough to do another 8 years. It's just, it grinds on you. You guys know.
Yeah.
You do it.
You know, I was talking to, that leads me to something about age that's interesting, but I want to point out to our listeners that Randy, who's seen and done everything, was just marveling. He was blown away by the quality of The Complete Guide to Hunting, Butchering, and Cooking Wild Game.
I was. I told
Volume
you guys.
One, big
I said
game.
That would take most people a lifetime.
You hear this, people?
And then you guys said, well, how long do you think? I said 3 years. And you guys looked at each other like, yep.
So if I'm reading what you're saying right, Randy, you feel like people are going to get their money's worth when they buy
it. I don't know
book.
What you're going to price it at.
$25, I think.
$25?
It's giving it away. You're giving it away.
Right. You should buy two of them at that price. I mean, it's really, I'm sitting
yeah, and
up
you
there.
Have, and you have a background that has to do with like you dealing people's money.
As a CPA, yeah, I get to disinherit the federal treasury.
As a CPA, Randy thinks you ought to buy that book.
If you don't buy that book, folks, you're not going to kill an elk next year.
That's exactly right.
I can promise you that. Or if you do kill one, you're not going to know how to take care of it out in the field.
That's exactly right.
And I was reading, Giannis, your piece about tuning up bows.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you come up with all that stuff? Experience?
No, he just. I told him about that.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
I told him about it, and he just wrote about it.
I think you need to make that like into a pocket guide.
Yeah, well, I got to say,
you
where did I come
that
up?
Book? You don't want to carry no. a 300 or 400
It's
pages.
Not like it's, I can't call it original content. I mean, yes, I did put it down in my own words, but like, it's not like I picked up a piece of wood and a string and then I eventually learned how to make a compound and then I learned how to tune a compound. You know, like all this stuff, like, yes, I've read, you know, hunting magazines and, you know, watched YouTube videos and all this stuff since I was a little kid. And so that's, you know, how it came out. But it's not like I made up how to, you know, get ready for archery season. Like a gazillion guys will be like, yeah, that's how I do it too.
Yeah.
You know, but.
Wow. I was impressed. I was thumbing through the book and I'm just thinking, you know what? This is a serious project. You guys go into a lot of detail on a lot of things.
I'm afraid that no one will ever read. I don't want to. I was half joking. I mean, I like to plug the book, but I was half joking. But I want to get to your thing about age. When you talk about like backpack hunting, how many years you think you got left?
Well, I always tell
like hunt as you hunt now.
Right. I told my wife I want to backpack hunt until I'm 65. And last
a long, it's like you got 13 years of hunt left. Am I doing my math wrong?
I'll be 51 in November, so 14, 15 seasons. But last year I packed out 3 bulls on my back. And
how many miles total? You packed bulls how many miles?
Hey, gosh, I'd be just a guess, Steve. I'm guessing combined all those trips, 30 miles.
Well,
something like that. But one of them was out of a canyon in Arizona, and it was ugly. I mean, even though it was only 2 miles each way, I remember saying, I'm not doing this.
Yeah, there's
anymore.
Different kinds of miles.
Exactly. And my guest hunter had blown out his ACL before the hunt, and he told me, he said, look, I've been waiting for years to hunt Arizona. I'm deferring surgery until after the hunt. Do you mind having a guy hobbling along? I'm like, hey, whatever.
So he went into it saying, I'm not going to pack.
Exactly. Right. He told me. I mean, and he was 55, I think. Blew out his ACL playing basketball down in Logan, Utah. And he shows up, and he's got a brace on his knee that looks like, you know, Colonel Steve Austin of the $6 Million Man. You're too young to remember that, Yana, so.
Yeah, no idea what you're talking about.
I know what you're talking about.
All right. See, again, we're aging ourselves here. But anyhow, he shoots this bull down in the canyon. Really nice bull.
Oh, he shot it.
Yeah, like a 320 bull. And
I'll tell you, I want to interject. I never met the guy. I bet that man did not have a torn ACL. I'm going to start saying that. I'm going to be like on every hunt. I'll be like, yeah, I got enough in me. I got enough in me to get down in that canyon and kill a bull, no problem.
Yeah.
It's just that once that happens,
yeah,
I'm out of here.
I'm out, yeah. No, so how hard can I hunt for how long? I don't know. I'm you get to a point, and I've said this on a few episodes, where you realize that there are a lot fewer hunts in the front windshield than what are in the rearview mirror.
Yeah, I got you.
And you enjoy every minute of every day of those hunts as you see the sand draining out of your hourglass. And you start having this internal fear. Gosh, oh man, my hip's hurting today. Is that going to lay me up for elk hunting? Because you know that there's a terminal point when you're hunting anything, let alone backpack elk hunting. So it's like,
I'm definitely still just too young and dumb to have those thoughts.
I know.
Are you? Or are you having those thoughts? You do.
Because like my brother's a couple years older than me. My brother is like, he started working out, lifting weights, you know? And now I've been lifting weights.
To train for hunting.
The only thing I'm thinking about, it's like, I'm married. I got three kids. Like, I'm not like working out because I want to be all like, go down to the beach. You know what I mean? Right. It's like, I work out because that's the thing I think about. Not being able to get up a hill.
Right. And so,
or getting smoked by Giannis. That Giannis would get to the hill way ahead of me.
You know, and I hunt, a lot of my guest hunters are younger than I am. And I drive a desk for a living half the year. And so I have to make a serious point to get out and hike every day. And I'm lucky here in Montana where I live, I'm a mile from a Forest Service trailhead. Going a 2-hour hike every day. And mentally, I am in way better shape to handle cold, terrible, miserable, ugly conditions than I was when I was 40 or 30. I mean, now I'll just put my head down, lean against the grade, and I don't even think about if I got to walk all day. Oh, well, I got to walk all day.
Yeah.
Whereas when I was 28, gosh, I had to walk for another 45 minutes to get there. This sucks. Now, don't even faze me. It's like, hey, man, I'm still hunting. I got some buddies who are, you know, they're done. They're cashed it in or whatever.
Yep.
And so mentally is fine. I mean, I wish I had the mental fortitude when I was 28 that I have today. It just comes with age.
One thing I think about when I think about getting old and not being able to hunt like I like to hunt is I think that me now would be able to smoke me when I was 25.
Oh, I think if I put myself back to when I was 25, even though I'm 50 now, I would agree. I was inefficient in how I operated, how I walked, how much gear I brought with that I didn't need, all those things. And just mentally, yeah, I could walk myself into the ground today, whereas in 25 I'd have to sit and have a sandwich after 2 miles.
I had a guy the other day telling me about a principle in fitness that my brother used to joke, has joked, that people that are big into CrossFit, you just get good at doing CrossFit, it doesn't do anything for you. And I was telling this guy that, and he says it half jokingly, but this guy was saying there's this principle in fitness called SED. Okay, so it's specific adaptations to imposed demands.
Huh.
Because what I've often wondered about is you could have people who are fit by any measure.
Yep.
Okay. Like, but you take them out, be like, oh yeah, you really ought to, before we go hunting the mountains, you really ought to like get in shape. Or, oh no, I just ran a half marathon, bro.
Yeah.
And you go out and it's like they have never done anything.
Yep.
It's such a specific thing that I really don't think you can replicate the demand. I don't think you can replicate the physical demands of mountain hunting, doing anything except maybe like mountaineering.
Yeah, I would agree. And that's why, a lot of my buddies go to the gym. Oh, I got to be on the cardio. I got to be working on this. Me, I put 20, 30 pounds in a backpack and I just hike.
And walk.
Yeah.
Because nothing replicates the uneven ground, okay, I'm going up a grade and then down a grade. I'm side hilling. I'm whatever.
Yep.
And I just, I haven't found any mechanical device that replicates it. So no, you can't. I just go hike.
Anything you do, like obviously any way you can become stronger, you know, and all that, it's like, great, sure, it's not going to work against you. But there's just something about the uneven ground. And I think another thing that really starts to throw people is, in addition to that stuff, in addition to just the physicality of it, there's this, all this layered stuff about cold, heat, boredom, other just discomfort things.
Yeah.
You know, uncertainties.
Mm-hmm. And but when
change in food.
Yep. When you're younger, all of those get to you.
Yeah.
And now, doesn't get to me at all. Okay. Throw my pack on. I'm usually hiking up the hill. I'm in a very light merino wool. And I got some layers. And yeah, it's cold, but I'm not really thinking about it.
Yeah.
I'm just got my head down. I got to get to the ridge so I can glass before the sun gets up. Whereas before, my mind would get distracted. Your mind gets distracted. You're not focused on hunting. And you just start losing it. Your edge is gone. And then you start getting cold. You start sniveling. You start whining. You start thinking about, oh, gee, I could have been huddled up next to mama this morning. Why the hell did I get out of bed?
Mama. It's a euphemism for Randy's wife.
That's right. Yeah, there's a joke to that if my wife listens to this. We ran into Jack LaLanne at an airport one time. Again.
No.
You guys,
is he related to Telly Savalas?
Kind of. Man, now I'm really aging myself. And he was like the original fitness expert on old broadcast TV.
Surely not before Slim Goodbody.
Oh, way before. He was like, he was like the first guy. So he's like 85, 90 years old. And he says, you know what? You young people need to know it takes discipline. And I'm like, oh, okay. Kind of taking notes here. He says, takes a real man to get out of a hot bed with a warm woman and go and jump in a cold pool because he needs to exercise.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I'm like, dude, you're 90 years old. I guess maybe you know what you're talking about. So anyhow, that's the inside joke about mama.
Getting out of bed from mama.
So
now you were brought up in Minnesota though.
Yep. Way up north.
So when did you start doing mountain hunts?
When I moved to Montana. I went to college in Reno and knew just about nothing about Western hunting while I lived in Nevada.
You didn't hunt there?
Yeah, I did.
Oh.
But I was terrible at it. I tried to hunt everything like I hunted whitetails. And then
throw down a stack of carrots and hang a platform. Hang a platform up the tree.
Yeah, there you go. And luckily stumbled into a few deer along the way while I was in Nevada. But when I moved to Montana, I just realized, you know what? If you're going to hunt elk on public land, you better figure it out, Randy, because they aren't standing next to the trailhead.
Yeah.
And it requires work. It's just, as quick as you accept the fact that hunting elk on public land requires exertion, you get way better at it. It's like you go through this period of thinking there's an easy way and you don't kill anything. I mean, I hunted elk for 6 years and never fired a shot at an elk because I thought there was an easier way.
People just hadn't been smart enough to figure it out yet.
Yeah. And finally I'm like, you know what?
Well, there's an easier way.
Well,
it's
yeah.
called cash.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, money solves a lot of problems.
You can buy elk, man. Yeah.
So,
but that wasn't the elk you were looking to purchase.
Right. And so after that, I'm like, all right, this is what I'm going to do. And I went in, slept on the mountain that night. Next morning, killed the bull. Like, holy cow.
What year was that?
That was in 1997.
Oh, okay.
And I think I've killed at least one bull every year since then, just doing the same thing. And it was like the light came on. Randy, quit thinking there's an easy way to do this.
Yeah.
There are easier ways to do it, but public land bull elk hunting on general tags is not an easy endeavor.
No, but you've made that your thing, man. Public land elk hunt.
Yeah, by accident almost, because of where I live, because of the fact that when you get in the TV world, elk are sexy. I mean, what sells better than a big bull elk screaming in a camera?
Big white-tailed buck on the cover of a magazine.
Well, that's probably true. But
I had a meeting with some magazine editors the other day, and they're like, you just... It's just a fact of life.
Oh, really?
The best-selling newsstand, when they any cover you do, you can't beat that. And it's got to be the biggest buck. So you'll have an article inside the magazine condemning fenced deer operations.
But you'll have one on
but
the
on the cover magazine is a fenced. It's got it's a fenced buck that you're never going to run into, and then you'll sell newsstand copies.
Yeah. Well, that figures.
It's just people like.
Yeah. That's
so, you know, to answer your question, a whitetail buck.
Yeah. All right. So I kind of got into that, and, you know, living in Montana, elk hunting's a big thing, like it is in Wyoming, Idaho, Colorado, other places. And then in the mid-90s, I started applying in all these western states and kind of going here, going there, getting to hunt elk in a lot of different places in a lot of different environments. Made me a way better elk hunter.
Is that right?
Because showing up in my backyard in Bozeman, Montana to hunt elk, you kind of know what they're doing. You're kind of doing the same thing every year. Oh, it's for early November. This is where they're going to be. I show up in New Mexico, and their season is, let's say, middle of October. Everything's different. So you really have to get your mind into a pattern and an idea of, these are not the same animal I hunt at home.
Mm-hmm.
And like you guys know on TV, my statement is I've got 5 days to figure it out, sort it out, and pack it out. I show up at a place I've never been, and we've got, what, $20,000 invested in an episode. I got to find some elk. And it doesn't matter that the weather's crappy. It doesn't matter there's a lot of hunting pressure on public land. I got to figure it out. You know, sniveling and whining isn't going to do any good. I can't change the weather. I can't change the hunting pressure. So over the course of doing that enough, you become, at least I feel, I've become a much smarter elk hunter than I was.
Yeah.
And people watch our show and say, Randy, come on, what's going on here? I never see this many elk on public land. And I don't know what to tell them. It's just, you know, either we're lucky, which we do get lucky at times, but we really have a system of here's how we do it. We spend the first 2 days figuring it out. Then we collect all the information. We sort it out. And then we got about another 2 or 3 days to try to get one on the ground and pack them out. It's that simple.
That raises a whole bunch of questions I got for you, but let me start with, with one that I already had in my head. I used to feel like, this is even hard to put, most hunters have like a thing they do. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So when I lived in Michigan, like what you did, like the thing you did was we bow hunted deer.
Yeah. Okay,
bow hunted whitetails. Then you do other stuff in addition. So like if you're a guy that lives in Wisconsin, you might just like you hunt agricultural whitetails, but every year you go on a destination hunt. But there's the thing that like the main thing, like if you took it all away, that thing would be left. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I've often thought like when you draw like what your thing is. Like for a long time when I lived in Montana, my thing was I like to archery hunt public land for elk. That's like the thing I really wanted to be good at.
Yep.
Like if I could be good at one thing, it would have been that. All the other stuff I did was auxiliary. Now I travel enough where I don't really have a thing anymore. But I always wondered, does the auxiliary stuff enhance your ability to do the thing? You're saying that it does.
Oh yeah. And you're
how is that though? Because you'll go somewhere, like I remember like hunting elk in New Mexico. I remember just thinking, this has nothing to do with hunting elk in Montana.
Right.
This ain't where the elk would be. This isn't what they'd be doing.
Yep.
You know? And I remember like I felt like it's like you're not training yourself, you're just on vacation.
Before we get Randy's answer to this, we gotta take a short break for our sponsors.
And when I tell you, Steve, what really prepped me good for elk hunting, you're going to crack up. My son and I fish walleye tournaments. And you're already looking at me like, what the hell does this have to do with elk hunting?
Yeah.
When you fish a walleye tournament, or even if you go walleye fishing, and probably bass fishing, the same thing. I don't bass fish, so I can't really say. But before you even go to the lake, you analyze, okay, what time of year is it? All right, it's June. The walleyes aren't going to be up way shallow, and they're not going to be out on the deep humps. So right there, I've eliminated about 80% of the lake. All right, what's the water temperature? What's the condition? what are they doing? It's kind of the same thing with elk. Elk do a different thing at a different time of the year based on certain needs. Food, escapement or survival, water, and breeding. Same thing fish do. And what I found myself doing when I would fish walleye tournaments is I'd figure out one thing that worked. Yeah. And I thought that would work every day, every place, all the time. And I'd catch fish 1 out of 10 days. And boy, when I found them, I'd just thump them. But then the other 9 days, I'd struggle.
That's how I fish yellow perch. Same rig.
And
all so, around the country, same rig, same depth. Sometimes I knock the shit out of them.
Right. And so my son gets bored to tears just doing what his old man does. So he's out there experimenting all the time. And that little guy, he's catching more fish than I am. And it starts driving home the point of, you know what? If you always do what you always done, you're always going to get what you always got. And elk hunting is kind of the same thing. If I go to New Mexico and think I'm going to hunt like I do in Montana just because it works in Montana, not going to happen.
How does hunting in New Mexico educate you about hunting in Montana?
Because it gets you the mindset that when you show up, the very first thing you have to do before you even get there is cross off all the places on your map where elk are not going to be. Scouting is not about finding elk. It's about eliminating where they're not going to be.
Ruling country out.
Right. So you look at my map when I start, anything that's within a mile of a motor, i.e. a trailer, a road, crossed off. Just don't even look there because I know other hunters are going to be there. And then I look at, all right, what is the season of the year? Okay, let's say it's the middle of October. All right, it's kind of the end of the rut. The bigger bulls are going to be off somewhere looking for their survival locations. They're going to be getting away from hunting pressure. They're going to make a living down in a canyon or some other place, just like they do in Montana. But in Montana, they're going to make a living in some really steep, nasty, blowdown jungle that has a little bit of food and a little bit of water nearby where they can not get shot for 5 weeks.
Just like black timber.
Yeah, or some small little pocket, some steep place that you just aren't going to think to look. In New Mexico, it's the same thing, but it's mostly canyons and other terrain differences.
So like they're going to go there. He's going to want to be down in New Mexico. He's going to want to be down in the canyon.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't really, in Montana, you don't really have like canyon country for the most part.
No. And so it's not that the nuances of the landscape or how those elk behave on that landscape teach me anything about how to effectively hunt them in Montana. It's the fact that it forces you to analyze what is the season of the year. Based on that season of the year, what are public land elk doing at that time of year? And based on what they're doing, what am I going to do to make sure I find them as often as I can? And I don't know if that's making sense.
No, it makes total sense.
Because most people will go out in the woods on a public land hunt, and they want to think that a new gadget or a new call or a new blah, blah, blah is going to bring an elk to them. It very seldom does. I mean, it might, but you're really hoping on gambler's luck if that's all you're thinking about. The people who, and the reason, what did you guys say in Colorado? Probably, 90% of the elk are killed by 10% of the hunters?
Sure.
Yeah. And the reason being is those 10% of guys have a system, and they know what to expect when they show up. When they show up, they've already got a plan laid out, either on a map or in their mind. They've got 3 or 4 options, and they're not wandering around opening morning before daylight thinking, well, I wonder if that ridge would be the spot or da-da-da. No, they're going to point A, and they go there. They don't see them. The afternoon, they're on point B. They'll have 6, 8 spots on their map to check out in a 5-day hunt, and 2 to 3 of those spots will have elk, and they'll just, through a process of elimination, get there, and when they find the elk, they'll kill one. I think elk are one of the easiest animals in the world to kill once you find them.
Once you find them.
Finding them is the hard part. And that's why, you know, I do a lot of writing and blogging, and I tell people, as crazy as this sounds, as simple as it is, you can't kill one if you can't find one. So quit worrying about all the techniques and tactics to kill one. Figure out how to find them. Because once you find them, you'll kill them.
Well, so what's your way of finding them?
Oh,
yeah.
Again, it goes back to that whole seasonal thing. I break it down into.
You think about seasons a lot,
right? I break it down into five periods. It's early season, pre-rut, peak rut, post-rut, and late season. And if you gave me one time of the year to hunt and try kill a big bull, it's going to be late season.
Let's just say a bull.
A bull.
Legal bull.
A legal bull in Montana is a branch antlered bull. I'm probably going to hunt him in the peak of the rut in September with a bow. Other states, it might be a different answer. But each of those five seasons, they have a different need. In the early season, you look at it, okay, the bulls still aren't really with the cows, the mature bulls. They're still putting on the feedback. You compare that to late season, and now they don't really care about food. They don't care about cows. All they care about is getting through hunting season. And they've got these sanctuaries they go to. And they and their bachelor groups go there year after year after year. And
what are those places? You said you named two. You named right. It in Montana.
Yeah, I mean,
like Blowdown, Nasty, right. Dog Hair.
As a general rule, I tell people, and this is Newberg's first rule of elk hunting, is where where hunters go, elk don't. And yeah. So if it's a place hunters can easily get to or don't have to exert themselves to get to, don't expect late season elk to be there. Maybe some late season cows, but not late season bulls. And I will share information with people about my early season spots or my peak rut locations. Fine. Everyone kind of knows where those are. But you're never going to hear Randy Newberg tell you where one of these sanctuaries are. Because one, they're hard to find. Two, once you find them, you can go there every year, year after year after year, and kill elk in that same spot. Because these bulls get old by living in these locations.
Yeah. Define spot. Like what size of ground? What size of patch of ground?
Oh, maybe 60 acres.
Yeah.
They will make a living in a 60-acre spot all the way through hunting season. In Montana, we got a 5-week rifle season. After the first shots, all hell breaks loose. The older bulls are in their bachelor groups, and they are going to the ugly, nasty places. They're going to be places that are hard to approach because of wind or noise or other things. And even if you do approach it, there's going to be a fast escape route.
Yeah.
And it just, I can almost look at a map now anymore with topo lines and say there's going to be elk there.
Okay, but how does that play into your idea that once you find them, they're easy to kill? He's protected by the wind. He's got a good escape route.
Yeah. You just got to wait him out. I think most people, when they find an elk, get way too excited. I got to go kill him. I finally found one. And they burst in there. They think, oh, over here, the wind's blowing out of the south. Well, you get over to the other side of the drainage or on the other hillside, and it maybe is blown out of the east. And so before they even get there, they've already announced to the elk what's going on.
Yeah.
And they see an elk bedded, and they're afraid another hunter's going to come shoot him
that's
in his bed.
That's what I always think.
And I just wait them out.
Like how? Like what?
Sit there until they stand up and offer me a shot, or I get to some place that says, all right, I'm 280 yards away. I know he's down in there. He's going to feed. I can see his tracks in the snow where he feeds every night. I'm going to let him feed up there, and I'll kill him. And I might have to wait until a half hour before the sun goes down. But if I wait, I'll kill him. I know I'm making this sound simplified.
No, I like everything you're saying.
But when I first started hunting elk, I made it way too complicated. I was looking for magic calls and, you know, gizmos and all this stuff, and it didn't work.
I got a great anecdote about a late season big bull that was killed. Some guy finally killed him, but he was in Gunnison. And I want to say, I can't remember if like it was I don't think it was a tough to draw unit, because I think as the story goes, I know that he was about like a 360 something bull, so pretty darn big for Colorado, yeah. Gunnison Basin. And during the rut in September, this bull would rut on private land, and it was like right adjacent to town. I want to say it was right outside of Gunnison, so everybody would see him. It's just this giant bull rutting around, right around, and then like. You know, rut would go by, rifle season would come around, and this bull would just disappear. Well, finally, one dude is just like literally glassing just like the same mountain that's been behind this bull forever and like looking way high up in the alpine, way above tree line. And there's like this little patch of willows, and there's like 100 yards away, there's like five like dwarfed little whatever, Engelmann spruce or, you know, whatever lives way up there, you know, just little like 6 foot trees. And he gets out of his spot and scope, he starts looking real hard and he thinks he can see tracks like connecting the two, you know? So he's like, I'm going to start looking at that patch. He climbs up and gets a little bit closer. And sure enough, at like 10 minutes before dark, up rises out of these five little spruce trees, this giant bull, and he walks like 100 yards over these little, you know, dwarfed high alpine willows, and he loses them in the dark. Next morning, he's like watching, and like just as it's cracking light, he just sees those antlers disappear in those five little spruce. He went up there, waited him out, killed that bull, and he said the pack job was just like something out of like a K2 documentary. Just like ice axes, crampons, just like scooting along the edge of this basin, you know, 11 plus thousand feet high. But yeah, I mean, he's got him hanging on his wall now and plays right into what he's saying. Think,
we were hunting mule deer a couple years ago in Colorado, and it was into the, I don't know what season it was, but there had been a couple seasons going on. And I remember just like looking through my spot and scope looking for mule deer and just seeing a nice bull and be like, you son of a bitch, that's where you're like, that's where you hang out, you
know? Yeah, I've
had like a post rut situation. Yeah, you know?
I've had that happen a lot of times in Colorado. I mean, I try to go deer hunting there every 2 or 3 years, and I'll be looking in these little pockets for bucks and does, and I'll be like, just like you said, you SLB. But
right.
I know I could probably come back there year after year and find him or other bulls around there. And I just, I don't know. I try when I do seminars about elk hunting, and I'm not an expert by any means. I just I have a lot of experience. That doesn't necessarily make you an expert. I try to tell people, think about what time of the year you're hunting and what are the needs the elk has at that time of year. In the peak rut, they don't care about food. You know, look, if back to when I said the best way to kill a big bull is late season with a rifle, the other would be at a water hole in a hot climate in the middle of the day during peak rut. I've been lucky and drawn Arizona and New Mexico, Nevada, Utah. I've drawn a lot of those tags for archery. What happens is the bulls take their cows up to bed them in the morning. And they usually stop and get some water somewhere along the way. And once they bed those bulls and they defend them from a few satellites, those bulls will sneak away from the cows about somewhere between noon and 3 o'clock. And they will come out in broad daylight, get a quick drink, and head back up to those cows. I've seen it so many times that when I have those tags now, I don't go back to camp and take a nap at noon. I'm sleeping at the water hole, or I'm sitting at the
like
water
I wouldn't
hole.
Be able to hunt with you because I like to take my nap.
Oh,
I'd have to like, nap from 11 to 12, then wake up and get ready for that.
But I think it's those sort of little tidbits that, like, in Montana, you maybe never really thought about it. Mm-hmm. And then you went to a really hot climate where, like, it happens more often, and you notice it, and you go, well, you know, maybe on a hot September day, this happens in Montana, too. And so, you know.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing, too, like, what I was talking about earlier about like having your like core activity and then just all the experiments. We're kind of talking about ways in which you become educated in general.
Yeah.
But I found at the same time that was ideal. I found that I don't respect, and I don't mean respect like in a way like, you know, or let me use a different word. I don't admire the hunting prowess of people who've just figured out a thing.
Yeah, it's a one-trick pony.
Yeah, like, you know, it'd be like some dude like, yeah, like in September, he catches a ton of salmon trolling in front of that river mouth.
Yeah.
He's the man. Everybody's like, yeah, but, you know, like anything could happen. And that fishery, whatever, like, so I kind of admire, like, adaptability, you know. Or I don't know people that, you know, they kill a buck every year, and then the whoever owns the farm they're hunting on sells the farm. They never hunt again. Yeah. It's like one man, he's like the dude that like, yeah, oh, John, man, every opening day he gets his buck. And it's like, yeah, but it's just like I have my little thing.
Yeah.
So through traveling and experimenting, I find that like just adaptability in and of itself is valuable.
Oh, I agree completely. I mean,
it makes you feel more comfortable because I used to feel very vulnerable when I first started hunting here, first started hunting elk here. I felt very vulnerable, like, man, would we be screwed if somehow this trailhead were to gain popularity?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean,
we'd be done.
Yeah.
Because the only thing we know is you park here, walk there, and they're there.
Yeah.
And like if they weren't,
yeah,
what the hell then?
Right.
So I do like the kind of stuff you're saying, like go anywhere and have a toolbox that you can, you know.
Yeah.
Draw upon.
I've just been lucky to get to hunt elk in so many places.
You might not even be comfortable answering this because it sounds like you're like tooting your own horn or whatever. But how many states or what states have you killed public land elk on?
Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada. Should have last year in Utah. In 2 weeks, people will get to see. You guys know how it is. 18 yards of bulls standing there, and I'm at, you know, with my archery gear thinking, come on, buddy, take one step. And either the cameras got them or I don't have them. And so I could have added Utah to that list if not for a very lucky, lucky bull last year. But
this is all like do it on your own public land hunt.
Right.
That's still seven states.
Is it?
I think that's what I got to.
Yeah. And for me, I don't really even think about it in terms of numbers. It's like
no. That's why I hesitated to ask you. Yeah, but I mean, it speaks for itself.
Yeah, it's just experiences. And, you know, like a classic example of a learning experience is: I'm in New Mexico. It's archery season. I mean, it's blistering hot. I go up high, and everyone else is up high.
High like what?
8,000 feet, mm-hmm. trying to get in some ponderosa. And I got my spotting scope out on this rock, and I'm looking down, and I see all these elk out on the flats in these grasslands. Grab my GPS and my map. I'm like, shit, that's BLM. So I go down there, and there's some guys camped there. And I'm like, you guys hunting these elk out here? Oh, no, you'll never be able to get up on them. I mean, you can't call them in. Well, I grew up spotting stock hunting in a lot of ways in the big woods of Minnesota. As weird as that sounds, you know, you're trying to find some place where a buck is hanging out and you're trying to see him before he sees you. Because if he sees you first, whew, one big jump and he's gone.
Still hunting.
Yeah, pretty much still hunting. So I'm thinking, you know what? Those elk got a bed somewhere out there. I go out there and I get to looking around. I can see where they're bedding. Wherever there's a break in the terrain, just a rock pile like 6 feet, you know, dropping a rock, they're bedding right up against those rocks
for shade or for
protection? Shade.
Yeah,
I go out there, and within a day, I arrow one of those bulls at like 2 yards, and we come packing it out.
I saw that.
Yeah, we come packing it out, and the guys, we walk past their camp. They're like, "Where the hell did you get that?" Out there, and I could have shot other bulls on that trip. Every time I've went back to that spot and been lucky enough to draw, those elk have figured out no hunters want to come out here because it's about a 3 mile hike. It's hot. There's no shade, but there's no hunters either.
Yeah.
So elk will go where they're kind of like this fluid animal that moves in response to pressure, kind of like water. I mean, you push against a water balloon and the water moves to a different spot in the balloon. It's kind of how these elk are. And so every year I hope I draw that tag because it's so consistent that I go to that trailhead, I walk out there, no one's going to be there, and there are going to be elk there.
Yeah.
So it's just one of those things, though, if you have enough experiences and go to enough different places, you kind of have those discovery moments and say,
And what's funny is, like, if someone tells you, like, describe that hunt, but put an antelope in there, they're like, oh, yeah, for sure. We'll go after those antelope way out there in the flats. But then someone puts an elk out in that same country and, can't kill those things.
Yeah. And I don't know. I think we on TV have a tendency to maybe create some narrow-mindedness among hunters from the standpoint of what works or how wide your thinking should be.
Yeah.
I mean, these are smart animals. They've figured it out. They've somehow, you know, a bull that lives 6 years on public land, he's no dummy. Just like a whitetail that lives past 3 years in the Midwest.
Yep.
He's no dummy. And don't discount some of the things they will do to stay alive. They just have figured out how to stay alive.
That spot you're talking about where you say, you know, if you go there,
uh-huh.
to me, man, like my most valuable possessions in life are those just handful of things.
Yeah.
Just like reliable things. And, you know, you really rarely have more than a half dozen.
I know.
So, and I'm not talking just one species. I mean, just like the things that work, and now and then, for whatever reason, you just scratch them.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Or you haven't done it in so long.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel like a thing anymore, but it's like knowing like the junk that works. And stuff goes away. Like I used to be, because it feels like stuff changes. Like I used to, one of my things, like that I counted among my things, like the ability that we would pound steelhead at the 6th Street Dam in downtown Grand Rapids, Michigan, right? I haven't done it in forever. The dam, they haven't changed the dam. They haven't changed the river. The steelhead are still there. But I feel like somehow if I went back, like I wouldn't be able to do it. I like lost it as my thing, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, I haven't done it so long. I almost feel like telling people. I recently had a thing where I had a friend move to a place I used to live. And I'm imploring him, I'm begging him to go sit a certain avalanche slide to see if a bear came out.
Yeah.
Because I hadn't hunted in a decade. And he goes up and says, yeah, I went up there, it was all snowy. I'm like, no, you're not listening to what I'm saying, dude. It doesn't matter. The chute will be fine. I don't care how much snow you got to wade through. Park your damn car, walk up there, and look. You know? And he thinks I'm trying to help him out. I'm just trying to know, like, do I still have a thing or not here?
Yeah.
And I'm telling him, like, you go this one time. You know, and he goes up, calls back, I saw a bear. I'm like, never go there again. That's it. I just needed to know that I still have that little thing.
Yeah.
You know, and it works.
In these little places, I'm a big advocate for conservation, but, and a lot of people know I sit on the board of the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. One of their people came to me and said, Randy, would you auction off your GPS with all your waypoints? And, you talk
that's
about
a bold mixed, question.
Yeah,
man.
You talk about mixed emotions because
you didn't do it, did you?
No, I haven't. And
you would have done it, but lost your GPS, so you couldn't.
I found that GPS.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah. Oh, Yana saw me a couple months ago. I was in panic mode. My GPS with all of this cherished, hard-earned.
Randy Newberg's brain.
Yeah, I'd lost it. I'd been out muskrat trapping, and I couldn't find the damn thing. Well, I have these custom seat covers made, and I put it somewhere where I wouldn't forget where I put it.
Yeah.
And that's where it was. I found it in May sometime. But so.
Well, now you can auction it off then.
No, I'm never. I will someday auction it off, but it kind of like what you were saying, Steve, about, you know, respect for people who are adaptable or whatever. I respect people who want to go out and figure it out, who want to take the journey rather than be led to the destination and say, here he is, shoot him.
Yep.
I mean, the guy who just racks his brain and works and goes out before work or whatever on the weekends and, you know, he's skimped for time, but somehow he shoots a bull every year. That guy's got my respect.
Yeah, I like that guy. I always want to help that guy out.
Me too.
And I always want to help out the guy with his kid.
Yeah. Oh.
The dude home with his kid, and I was like, yeah, you know what I would do. But, yeah, man, the thing about auctioning off, it's just like you said, you're a proponent of conservation. It just brings up a thing that I think about all the time is when people talk about the need for hunter recruitment,
right? Yeah.
The hunting will have that. The thinking goes that for hunting to survive politically, I mean, I'm not telling you that, just for listeners, that for hunting to survive in today's political climate, we need to have healthy, robust numbers, right?
Yep.
But a thing that critics of that say, including many friends of mine, who critics of the idea of hunter recruitment, will be like, well, why would you want to increase the likelihood of someone being in your spot?
I hear it all the time.
And when I get asked by people, and I often will give talks, and the thing that always comes up when I give a talk is people be like, what can we be doing? Or why are hunter numbers stagnant? Or why does the average hunter get older? So, you know, what do you see from the people you meet? I'm like, you know what? Inspiring people to want to go is not a problem. right? There's plenty of motivation out there.
Yeah.
The cost, I don't think it's like there's not a lot of people. There aren't tons of people who want to hunt but can't because of the cost.
Yep.
They're not hunting because they don't have a good spot. And a lot of people aren't willing to just make the sacrifices necessary to find good spots. I've found I take people out, take them on amazing trips, and then they aren't going to replicate that amazing trip unless they do tons of hard work to find their own stuff. And that's it for them.
Yeah.
And when it comes down to it, so like if I was consistent with what I'm saying, I would give up all my spots.
True. You would.
Because I would be able to make a handful of people, but it's just not something I'm willing to do. And some people, like, you know, my older brother, he just thinks that all this talk is just ridiculous.
Yeah. And I've listened to some of your podcasts where this topic's come up, and I'm kind of torn between. I'm all about making sure opportunity exists, but not handing it to them. I think the worst thing you can do for a prospective hunter is to hand them something.
I found that to be true personally.
And just show them the easy way. Oh, well, that's all there is to that. And you've cheated them out of the entire experience of what hunting really is, in my mind.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the value that when people say hunting recruitment, that's not what I think of. You know, bringing them out there, make sure they kill something the first day. No, you know, let them get a little cold. Let them, you know, maybe feel a little lost. Let them have to work. And that's the part that is going to make them a hunter for the long term. If it's easy, there's no reward in it.
Yeah, I don't want to make new hunters just for the sake of doing it.
No.
If you told me, if I signed some treaty with the non-hunting public that said, we'll never mess with you, okay, in perpetuity, you will not be messed with politically or environmentally, I'd be like, okay, I'll just be the only – then I just want to be the only guy that hunts. As long as you're telling me that you're not going to mess with habitat, you're not going to mess with the hunting rights, you know, that's fine. I'll just be the guy.
Do you think
I'll take that job. You know?
I've heard you talk about your brother's opinion on this. And growing up in Michigan, I'm assuming it was a little bit like where I grew up in Minnesota, where everybody hunted and fished.
Everybody. Every household.
Right.
Every household.
Yeah. I mean, I did not know anyone who really ate beef growing up. Until I went off to college, I didn't realize how much beef, chicken, and pork got consumed.
Oh, man. Definitely. We ate all kinds. Like, we ate, there was all around. Domestic meat was there, but everybody hunted, but it wasn't like a subsistence area by any stretch. No.
And so the point I'm getting to is because some people grow up in that environment where you just work your butt off and you hunt and you fish and you trap and you do all those kind of things, you encounter experiences that shape and form you. So you don't need to be quote unquote recruited as a hunter.
Yeah.
Everybody I grew up with, they were going to be hunters because we came from a society of hunters. That was our identity. That you weren't, oh, I'm a carpenter and then I'm a hunter. It was the reverse. No, I'm a hunter. Just who you were. If you were a young kid, you looked up to the guys who were hunters in your community or fishermen or trappers or whatever. And so I think a lot of quote unquote problems we attribute to hunting recruitment are just the environment or atmosphere in which we're trying to bring them into it. Trying to bring someone who's only exposed to nature or to the natural world for one day out of a year, you're not going to convert them to being a hunter like we think of a hunter. You have to put in the effort and the work to immerse them to a level where they understand all the other parts of hunting.
You know, I thought about that because I've been befuddled at times by taking people out on that one day a year thing, you know? Like, okay, I took you on this, like, we flew up, we did like a caribou hunt. Surely you'll now be a hunter. And then they just never hunt again.
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand, dude. But then we were talking about this not long ago, I feel like. But if someone took me sailing, They're like, hey, man, you want to come sailing for a day? Like, oh, why not? Later on, they're like, I can't believe he never became a sailor. Yeah. I was like, no, dude, I just thought it'd be interesting to go sailing for a day. We went sailing. That's great.
Right.
I mean, do I regret going sailing? No. Do I want to, like, be a sailor?
Yeah.
No. It was fun.
Yeah.
You know? I think a lot of people look at it that way. Like, I look at it like, do you self-define as a hunter or not?
I do. And that's
because, you know, most people don't look at the world that way.
Well, people ask me, I think we were doing an interview with you guys, I think, and someone said, Randy, introduce yourself. Randy, I'm Randy Newberg, hunter. It's just, that's who I am. Yeah, professionally, I'm a CPA and everything else, but everyone who knows me, all the people I hang out with, they're hunters. And we look at the world through a lens that is so much different than everybody else. And I used to think that I was the same as everybody else. But after you have enough of these life experiences, interacting with enough people who don't hunt or see the world differently, you realize that hunting gives you a vision of the world like nothing else.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing I can think of compares to the vision of the natural world you get if you are a hunter.
You mentioned trapping a couple of times.
Yeah.
Before we get into trapping too far, let's just take a quick break.
So, Randy, you mentioned trapping a couple times, and now you mentioned that a hunter looks at the world in a way that no one else looks at it. I'll tell you that when I'm driving down a road and I drive over a bridge.
I know what you're saying.
And I look off the bridge.
Yeah.
No one is looking at what I'm looking at. Or not no one. Very few individuals, a select few individuals,
right,
are looking off the bridge that way.
Exactly.
And just like when I drive through a valley and I'm looking up the mountains, like I do not see what other people see. I think that hunting in some way makes it very difficult to look at the natural world with passivity.
Completely agree.
It's like you're looking at it sort of in a way, and it sounds egotistical, but you're looking at it in a way like, well, how does this like pertain to me? In some way, like, where are the animals or what's up with that spot? And it's like, I can only see it that way. If I go on vacation, we just went on family vacation to Hawaii. The whole time, I'm looking up those hills being like, no, what would a fella find up there at his bone arrow? You know what I mean? Like, I can't not see things that way. I can't. My wife has just been baffled by my inability to just sit on the beach.
I am the same way. My wife will say, is that all you think about?
Well, yeah, I'm sitting on a beach? Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about one thing.
when we're doing whatever, you know, we might be driving down the road, and I'm like, on our way home, I want to stop there. Kind of like you're saying about the bridge. Because at that culvert right there, I'm pretty sure I could trap a muskrat.
Yeah. That's what I was getting at when I said, like, driving over a bridge. Like,
yeah.
So I grew up trapping in Michigan. You grew up trapping in Minnesota.
Yeah.
A lot of the, I don't know, 50%. I need to lay a little bit of groundwork here. Like, when you're trapping, you run what's called a trap line. And no one just sets a trap. Like, you run a trap line, and your trap line might be six, what we call sets or locations where you have a trap set. Or in the case of a mink longliner, you might have 200, 300 traps out, or what you call sets. So when I was trapping, 50% of my sets that I would make would be on public right-of-ways of bridges.
Yeah. For mink and muskrat.
Mink, muskrat, raccoon.
Yep.
So, like, I divided trapping up in my head, water trapping, land trapping. Yeah. So land trapping, you'd trap low, it was early. Like we'd start land trapping. I can't remember now when I would do it. I'd start land trapping October 10. And you'd have 20 days of land trapping before water trapping opened up. During land trapping, I would target red fox. But, I would get gray fox and I would get raccoons that weren't that valuable. Because raccoons hadn't come into prime quite yet. And then November 1, I would start water trapping zone 2. When I started water trapping zone 2, I would set tons of public right-of-ways where you are climbing into, you don't, you're, it's not public land. You don't have permission on the land, but you could park your car on the bridge or park your car on the side of the road and sort of skirt down the bridge abutment, abutment, get down in the river, and then make your set below the high water mark. So you just learn the same way now as a hunter, I look at like a brushy strip between two cornfields in a certain way. Yeah, driving over bridges, I had a way of, I would just be able to assess it so quickly, whether it was interesting to me or not.
And I, a lot of people ask me, well, how has trapping helped you as someone who hunts?
Because you still trap.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Giannis, you came with me one day last year. I just sent all the muskrats to Canada to the fur auction, and they sold them last 2 weeks ago.
What was your average for large?
Oh, it's terrible this year.
There's an article in the New York Times yesterday about how fur's coming back.
Oh, no.
They've been saying that for a bazillion.
Thanks to Putin, the Russians are trying to invade everything in Eastern Europe, so it's, at least for a guy who's a muskrat mink guy like I am. 2 years ago, I got $12 a piece for a double XL muskrat.
Yeah.
This year,
which
they were
one in five muskrats.
Right. This year, they were $5 a piece. I mean, premium winter skins. But, you know, 2 weeks out of my winter, I get to go and goof around, catch 300 muskrats, a few minks, some raccoon, dozen beaver. And it's just...
You'll catch 300 scrats. We always call them scrats.
Scrats, yeah.
You'll catch 300 scrats in 2 weeks.
Oh, easy. If I didn't have taxis to worry about, I could catch 1,000 of them in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
What I trapped... I tried a lot of muskrats, but I trapped fox, coyote, and incidental to that would be raccoon, possum, skunk on dry land.
They have possum in Michigan?
You kidding me?
Really? I didn't know that. We didn't have them in Minnesota. I didn't know they had them.
I bet they do now.
Probably.
There's two things. There's two animals that are traditionally southern that have been really expanding the range northern. And that only has to do with climate change. I don't think it has to do with just slow adaptability. Raccoons. Yeah. Well, several javelinas seem to move northward all the time.
Yeah.
Opossums are moving northward. So, yeah, get that stuff incidentally. Then I would trap muskrat, mink, beaver, raccoon, and then you were allowed, depending where you were, one or two river otters. And I would really work hard to get my otters, but I wouldn't sell my otters into the fur market. I'd sell them into the taxidermy trade.
Oh, okay. Huh.
Because they were... a novelty item.
Right.
So, like, when I was traveling to Michigan, a bobcat in Michigan was worth $15.
Right.
Taxidermists give you $120
for it. Yeah. Here, right now, a good Western, as they call them, lynx cat, even though it's not a Canadian lynx.
Yep.
You know, a really good colored, spotted belly, you know, $500-$600.
Yeah.
Taxidermists will still pay you $100 for them.
Yeah. So it would vary.
Whereas,
you know, back then, when in my area, coyotes were just coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember the first two coyotes, I sold them in taxidermists.
Okay.
Because people were still kind of like, whoa, coyote. And like, people weren't as tied in then as they are now. Because like pre-internet, somewhat pre-internet. So it's like what you had access to. Like, I always argue now that the souvenirs are obsolete. Yeah.
Can I stop you there? You said somewhat pre-internet when you were trapping.
Yeah, because I remember I had email and way pre-internet when I started trapping.
Okay.
When I quit trapping, there was a university email thing.
Okay. Because I was going to say, the internet, for me, when I was trapping growing up, Al Gore hadn't even graduated from college yet to invent the internet. But anyhow.
Yeah, I want to clarify the point. I set my first trap, caught my first muskrat in 1984, 10 years old, way pre-internet. But I was thinking, when I quit trapping at 22 years of age, there was, at the college I went to, there was some kind of university email thing, and people were just starting to mess around. So... Yeah, but at that time, when I sold those two coyotes, it was around that time. And I was saying that people used to have where you could go into a taxidermist, and they're like a provincial bunch. You know, you go into a taxidermist and be like, here's a coyote, and it wouldn't occur to them that there's guys out west with stacks of coyotes, like coyotes stacked up every which way, and they're begging someone to take off their hands and be like, holy shit, you know, I'll buy that coyote off you. So, you know, it was like that at the time. And as a side note, I was going to say, like, souvenirs are going obsolete. Like, people were like, well, I went to France. You know, I bought you this bottle of wine. But, dude,
Buy it online.
I'd buy that bottle of wine at Safeway, man. You know what I mean? Like, I could go online, but there's nothing I can't, unless you find something out in the woods, there's nothing you can't give someone they just can't get. So it's like weird now to buy people, like you go to Hawaii and buy a seashell necklace. It's just weird because like, yeah, I go to seashellnecklaces.com. But we're also going to bring up, like, I mean, that was going to bring up about trapping is you, so you're 10 years older than I am.
Yeah.
Which means you hit the fur boom.
Right.
I missed the fur boom. The fur boom definitions vary. It's largely accepted that, like, the great American fur boom, 1978 to 1982.
Yeah, I hit it perfectly.
Some people fudge it by a year or more, but there's just this explosion of good fortune for fur markets having to do political, economical, fashion.
Yeah.
Commodities.
It's a hedge against commodities. It's when the dollar is going one way, furs can be going another. All those things
and fur,
came together.
Everything exploded.
Right.
Fur prices. For fur, like anything with hair, fur on it, skyrocketed in value.
Right.
And overnight, and every Tom, Dick, and Harry in the world went out and bought a bunch of traps.
Yeah, for sure. It was unbelievable how many people in my little town of Big Falls trapped.
Now, you got to figure adjusting for inflation.
Yeah.
Muskrats. It was like the era of the $6 muskrat, but we're talking in 1979.
Yeah. In 1984, my first year in college, I came home for Christmas break, and me and my uncle and I, we got 600 muskrats in a week. And we
trapping what?
What's that?
Trapping what kind of cover? Like what kind of habitat?
Up in these beaver flowages in northern Minnesota, north of Highway 2, you were allowed to cut the tops off their rat houses.
Yeah.
And so you'd cut it off, put a couple traps in there, put the lid back on, patch it all up. You'd have your trap on a long wire. So when you walked by, the muskrat got in your trap and you knew because he went down the hole into the water, pulled the wire up against the hut.
And Michigan, you can't molest a hut.
Oh, really? Okay. In southern Minnesota at that time, you couldn't. I think you can now, but we would go do that. And one guy would just walk around these beaver flowages and pull the muskrats out of the traps, put the traps back in, and the other guy would sit at a fire and skin muskrats. Because if it was 20 below, you know, if you didn't skin them right away, they were
hard.
Oh, yeah, you weren't going to get them skinned. And so at that point in time, to be a college freshman and come home and get $5-6 for muskrats, and your half of them is, you know, 300, I went back to college for winter semester, man, it was Domino's and high quality beer that semester. It just how it was. I came back spring break of that college year and we caught 125 beaver in a week. And we were catching them so fast.
That was trapping northern Minnesota.
Yeah. And like a lot of my buddies, we were catching so many, we didn't have time to skin them all. And the fur buyer would come and we'd have them laying in the basement of my uncle's house, stacked up literally like firewood. And the guy would say $20 a piece in the round. In other words, you didn't have to skin them anything. He didn't size them. It was just $20 a piece. Take them. And he'd just sit there and slap his $20 bills on the table. And we were just, I mean, we thought we had really hit the lottery.
So, yeah, furs sold in three ways. You sell it during the fur boom. Trappers got interested in trapping faster than they could learn their trade.
Correct.
And there's a lot of people out for a quick dollar, and they weren't interested in sort of the discipline and art of being a trapper. And they would sell a lot of fur round.
Yep.
And round means on the animal. So fur buyers, like, let me add a layer onto this. There's three ways to sell fur. There's three ways to sell fur, meaning in the round. I got too many ideas going at once here. There's two ways that you actually sell fur. A fur buyer, like a country fur buyer, or a fur auction.
Yep.
During the fur boom, you had country fur buyers, just like a guy buying fur out of his garage.
Yeah.
He's selling to the auctions. And the same trappers can basically sell to those auctions as well. But to sell fur to an auction, you got to sell it fleshed and dried.
Right.
That's hard. It's harder to learn how to flesh a beaver than it is to trap a beaver.
Yeah.
During the fur boom, guys would go out and trap. And just every night on their way home from trapping, go to the country fur buyer. and sell fur in the round to the fur buyer. Or you could skin it, which is the easy part, and sell it green.
Yeah.
I sold all my raccoons, all my beaver green.
Wow.
Skinned, but not fleshed and stretched.
Right.
But I could sell them at a small auction that way because I could just freeze them in a big chest freezer.
Okay.
So during the fur boom, you had a lot of guys that didn't know what end of a knife was sharp, but they were trapping and selling to fur buyers in the round. But you're walking and selling Red Fox in the round for $60.
Yeah, it was crazy.
But again, remember, we're talking about 1979.
Right, and you take those dollars for inflation. I remember...
It's like having a couple $100 Red Fox.
Right. In 1982, my senior year in high school, that fall, I caught 50-some mink before school, just running a trap line on my way to school. And I think I averaged like $24 a mink. That's male, female.
In the round.
No, I mean, because they're quick to skin and dry and stretch. But
yeah, because they come off clean.
Yeah.
Like a mink, you don't have to flesh them too much.
No, it's easy. And I just think about that now. I'm like, man, if I could get whatever $24 was in 1982, if I could get that today, I'd have to get out of outdoor TV. Because I'd be trapping mink all day long.
But you in a way, you were getting screwed because what I want to say was when I came in 1984, I was coming in on the euphoria of the fur boom, but without the prices.
Right.
There was a lot of information out there. There was a lot of traps, used traps out there, but I had missed it by a couple of years.
Yeah.
So, but I came in at a time when people, there was still effort because it hadn't gone totally bad yet. We would get, and I was 10. I couldn't really start it any earlier. The first day I ever set traps was, I set traps at midnight on November 1st, 1984. By 7 a.m. on November 1st, 1984. It's like I have an alibi for that day, dude. I can tell you exactly where I was. By 7 a.m., we had 3 muskrats.
Wow.
I think we had 9 traps. We had 3 muskrats. 2 were caught. One was caught in front of Joe Babcock's house in a 110 Conner Bear. One was caught in front of this foster family's house on North Lake, 110 Conner Bear. And we caught one on the north trending side of Crazy Mary's Point in a number one single long spring trap set under a stump where a bank den entered. I could tell you every damn detail of that day
so,
in 1984. And we sold those muskrats for, I think, our big ones that year. We caught 20 the first year. And my old man lent us the money. Like, I have an older half-brother. He gave us six number one long spring, Victor Long Springs. Then what we did is our old man lent us money. He drew up a little contract, even on yellow legal paper, and lent us enough money to buy one dozen Northwoods 110 Conner Bears.
Okay.
And we caught our first year trapping 20 muskrats, one smallish raccoon, and made enough to not only pay for the Conner Bears we bought, but to go buy a bunch more Conner Bears, and I was off running.
Yeah.
Because at the time, if you caught a buck mink is worth twice as much as a female.
Right.
Even then, minks held because you would get $40 for a mink.
Yeah. Oh, it was crazy.
And I remember my two brothers, one time late in the year, I like quit. I pulled out of our trapping collective. So I trapped my two brothers. I can't remember. Something was going on at school. But anyways, they went to set some more muskrat ponds, and I didn't participate. And they came home and picked up 2 mink out of muskrat sets. And I remember them dudes walking the door with $40 a piece and being blown away. I remember in 1986, I shot a mink with a 32 special, took its head off, and bored a groove down the center of his back. And we took it to a fur buyer named Abe Salicina, and Abe Salicina offered me like $4 for that mink, and my old man cursing him out.
Really? Because he thought you were getting the bad treatment?
Yeah. Huh. He said, I invite you to sell that mink for more somewhere else. Huh. And the dude wound up being right. No one would take the mink.
Yeah.
So it was missing all the good parts.
So now, here you are. What? You said you're 22 when last time you trapped?
So I trapped from the time I was 10 to the time I was 22, and I thought I was taking – I was so into it. I was paying. I remember paying a guy named Mark June, who later became like a video whitetail guy.
Yeah.
I remember paying Mark June $250 for a day's lessons in trapping red suburbia red fox.
Huh. So do you miss it?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
But I still set traps because I eventually settled into the thing I like to do is trap beaver through the ice.
Oh, I love it.
It became my thing. Mm-hmm. I liked everything about it. We would go out in the ice, December, January, with a push broom. And push broom snow away on the ice looking for bubble trails, exhale trails.
Yeah.
And take axes and chainsaws and shit and get down through that ice. Yeah. And stringing snares and stringing 330s. And I loved every minute of it. I liked falling through the ice.
Yeah.
It's like I liked everything about it, man. And I still now will trap. I trapped the beaver this spring. I'll still trap it, and I'll send it and get it tanned, and I'll have it made into stuff.
Yeah.
So I trap my own hat. I trap my own mittens. I got some stuff getting made right now. I got a beaver that my brother's having made into a hat for his wife. So I'm still in the fur business, but I'm just into personal use.
Gotcha.
And then I eat the beaver meat. Yeah. I like beaver meat.
Well,
but I'm not into trap. I'm not trapping numbers like I used to.
No.
I'm just after a beaver.
And I know some people are listening to this and probably thinking, man, these guys, they're off their rock here talking about trapping. But if you've trapped, you understand the excitement of laying in bed at night thinking, oh, last set I made tonight, that's going to catch one in the morning. And you almost can't get to sleep at night.
No, you can't.
It's worse than opening the night before opening day of deer season.
I could never sleep between setting because we'd go out and set at midnight for scratch. Well, because we lived in the high competition area.
Okay.
We'd set our we'd pick like what's the primo spot.
Yeah.
And we'd start at midnight and we'd set like even up into whatever age when I quit trapping, I would still set traps from midnight through to dawn up to dark.
Wow.
And I would get a lot of sets out. I would punch in usually more than 75 sets.
Wow. See,
for mixed bag, from otter to scrats.
It was never that competitive for me. I mean, everyone kind of, okay, Randy's going to be out here. John's going to be out there. It was no one bothered. But before we get done or get too far.
No, I'm not. I'll just get started on talking.
All right. Giannis is sitting there looking at us like, man, these guys can really spin it out. But
I want to just before you make your point, I want to say one last thing about the people think you're off the rock about trapping.
Yeah.
I remember making an observation, and I'll stand by this today. The most skilled outdoorsmen are trappers.
No doubt. I agree.
And here's how I'll prove it. If you fish, there's people out there who just fish.
Yeah.
Right? Now, anyone that hunts knows how to fish.
Correct.
Anyone that traps knows how to hunt and fish.
That's exactly right.
It's just like, you know what I mean? It's just a thing. You're better. A trapper's better than everybody else.
You
know more bits of. And I often talk about. I made this point before about guys who hunt lions with hounds. People be like, "Oh yeah, what's the challenge in shooting a lion out of a tree?" And then I met some houndsmen who hunt lions.
Oh, they're.
And I realized that guy holds more bits of information in his head.
Yeah.
Right. If you could somehow quantify information the way we have digitally, right? And add up how many bits of hunting information does a guy who shoots whitetails on his father-in-law's farm in Wisconsin, how many bits of information are in his head? And how many bits are in a houndsman's head? He has gigabyte upon gigabyte more information in his head.
Yeah, I agree.
A good trapper, you can't, when you talk about reading sign, the ability to read sign, and it's just in spatial awareness and having a landscape map in your head, you can't get closer to it than a hardcore trapper.
Yeah. The anticipation that that trapping requires as far as anticipation of what that animal's going to do just makes you think and experiment so much more than hunting does. Because trapping, they are stepping within a 2-inch area. You guys say, I need him to step right here. Okay. Archers, 40 yards is good enough.
A circle 40 yards.
Yeah.
Which means an 80-yard circle.
Right.
A circle with an 80-yard diameter.
Right.
And we're talking about a circle that's 1¾ inches.
Yeah, and I know some archers who are just badass woodsmen, but try get that to a 2-inch circle.
And the benefit is With archery, you need to be there when it happens.
Right.
With trapping, you don't need to be there when it happens.
True. Anyhow, I want to get to this point, Steve. So I read your book about your bison hunt in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I knew you back when you did your show on Travel Channel, and I lucked out. I drew a free range bison tag in Montana it was January 2013. I said, "All right, I got to go find a good bison book." I read your book, and you are either a stark raving nut or one hell of an author that makes that hunt and the danger involved seem way greater than it is, or you just have a death wish. I read that, and I said, this guy is, he owes the world a tragedy if this is how he conducts himself out in the wild all the time. Is this just like a really good piece of writing, or was it really that wild?
It was like the most intense 10 days that I've spent hunting.
It's some of the most intense reading I've ever had.
But here's the thing. I'll tell you a couple things. It's like, that's a different kind of hunt. Like the Copper River hunt.
Yeah.
Is a difficult hunt, and it used to be much more difficult because at the time I drew it, all the land along that river was inaccessible because it's tribal land. Now they have a set access fee for people to draw that tag.
Okay.
At the time I drew it, there was no such thing. So you have this river, and there's herds of animals that migrate a good distance, 40 miles. They calve up by these glaciers in the Wrangles, and they winter down in these gravel flats, these willow flats along the Copper River. And there's willy-nilly distribution. It's a humongous area with maybe 100 animals in it spread out over a ton of ground. And at the time, you could not hunt the river corridor.
Okay.
All the huntable land. You could find them down below high watermark, okay, on a gravel flat that was below high watermark and kill it there, okay, as long as it didn't go up.
Right.
If it walked up, you're screwed.
Yeah.
Or you could get past the buffer along the river by wading up a tributary stream to get in, because then you're fine, you're below high watermark, to get into the hunting area. The year I drew a tag, they gave out 24 permits. Four guys killed an animal. The season's 8 months long. They find that most people don't show up. Once you find out, they send you a letter. After you draw the tag, they send you a letter. They used to. This is 2004. They send you a letter saying, like, okay, you drew the tag, but basically you're screwed. Because there's serious land ownership issues. You have to understand what you're getting into. It's like there's major access issues. There's a lot of barriers to this.
Yeah.
I went, and the minute I drew it, I sold the story of this before going. I sold the story of this to a magazine, Outside Magazine, where I was a writer.
Yeah.
And at the time, I lived a very hand-to-mouth existence. So I'm doing a story that will offset my cost in doing this. So I'm going to get like $4,000 to do the story. The hunt, all everything in, is going to cost a lot. I had to do it. So I find now when people say, like, well, why did you write like a book? Like, why did you write your book? There's two reasons. There's not the real reason, but there's like this like reality reason that oftentimes has to do with money.
Right. It's just pragmatic.
It's like, because I was going to write an article about it. You know, and I sold the thing. Why did you really do it? Well, I'm very interested in buffalo. I only write about what I'm interested in. I got in, as the story chronicles, my interest in buffalo was spawned by me finding a buffalo skull in the Madison Range.
Here in Montana.
In a weird place, like 9,000 feet above sea level in the mountains.
Yep.
I went up having a genetic line extracted from it. I had it radiocarbon dated. Like, the book tells this big story of buffalo in America. But the minute I found that skull, I was like, man, I'm going to write a book about these animals. I just don't know what the storyline is going to be. And then I drew that tag. So I had a lot riding on finding a buffalo and killing it.
Yeah, okay.
And I got into situations doing that were – and I chronicle all this in, like, very detailed way.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, when I was doing that book, you know, like, because some people just fabricate whole cloth, and then publishers get in trouble and writers get in trouble.
Yeah.
So when I wrote that book, they made a big point. Like, I had to go over everything on maps, provide names for people for them to call. They just, like, wanted to know. But I could take you up there right now and walk you through it. And once you see what I'm talking about, it would all make sense in that you're confined, in my case, you're confined to either being in the Dadena, Nadena, or Chetislina River. You're not going to get to any of those rivers. The only way to get to any of those rivers is wait till it freezes, which is the, like the other guys that kill buffalo are hunting off snow machines.
Going up the frozen river.
Wait till the river freezes.
Okay.
And they're killing them in the winter when the bad weather has pushed them down into the willows. The letter I got from Fish and Game that says you're screwed points out successful hunters on this hunt. And that's why they give you 8 months. It starts September 1 and you have 8 months. The reason they give you that is because the river freezes. They say most guys that kill buffalo on this hunt do it off snow machines when the animals are pushed down in the river flats. But you should be aware that river hasn't frozen in 3 years.
Okay.
They hadn't been killing any buffalo off that hunt. When I first drew the tag, I was like, sweet. I talked to my brother. I got a brother in Anchorage. He's got friends with snow machines. I'm going to go up in March, and we're going to go up. You got your low daylight, but you just basically cruise the river up and down, until there he is standing in a, gnawing on a hunk of willow out on a willow island. It got where it just wasn't going to be. And so I got this idea that I'm going to have friends bring me down and we're going to hunt together. And I'm at first like, oh, we'll find one on the river. So I get my brother, two of our buddies who are avid rafters, and we get down, and there's three main river areas we have identified as being areas where they've been killed in the past. We pass one, pass the other, get to the third, and have seen like a set of tracks.
Yeah.
These guys have jobs.
They're not starving like you are.
They're like, sorry, dude. I'm like, I guess our only option here is that you'll leave me here and, you know, like cell phones and shit. Like, that's not going on.
No.
You'll leave me here and you'll come back and get me like a week, over a week from now on a Sunday, and I'll be back down here. I have no way of getting up or down the river. I'm on the Copper River at the mouth of a tributary, and I got a little patch of ground I'm looking at. You're not doing shit because I can't even leave the little island I'm on because I'll be on off land.
Right.
And I know I'm going to write about this, so I can't do like a wink and nod.
Right.
I could get checked into, or I'm also very vulnerable because I can't have a dead animal land somewhere I can't have it land.
Yeah.
You know? At that point, it's like, I'm going to have to just start. I'm just going to have to put waders on and wade up this cold-ass river by myself. And if I find one, and I did, shoot a 1,000-pound animal that I need to then move by myself down to where I can get it into my buddy's raft next week. And there begins like a whole set of problems.
Right. So you had invited me.
And so, like, yeah, it was, like, it's not replicable, but it's, like, it all, it seems weird, like, the shit that I had to go through. But when you start factoring in, like, all these decisions, and I'm constantly being egged on by a couple things. The rareness of drawing the tag.
Right.
They've since made it retroactively once in a lifetime.
Right.
Once you draw a buffalo tag in Alaska, and there's some gravy hunts. There's like the Delta Junction hunts. You're basically shooting buffalo out of oat fields. Once you draw a tag, and it proved to be once last time. Once you draw it, you cannot draw it again. I'm not talking successfully harvest. Right. Once you draw, you cannot draw it. So I'm now incapable, and I was correct. It was literally a once-in-a-lifetime hunt. And I knew that I wanted to write my damn article, and I wanted to then write my book, and the way to do that was to kill that buffalo.
I read your book.
I wasn't going to leave.
Yeah. You had called that summer and said, hey, we should go to Southeast Alaska and do a Sitka blacktail hunt. And then you and Dan came down with limes, I think, and we had to cancel that hunt. Mm-hmm. And then I read
this. And a bunch of other hunts.
Yeah. And I read that over the course of that fall. I'm reading the book. And I'm like, if this guy takes this many risks just to write a freaking story, I'm really glad he got Lyme's disease. And I'm not up in the Alpine of Prince of Wales Island trying to survive with this crazy ass.
Because get sick.
I mean, looking back on it, do you say, what the hell was I thinking?
No.
No. Okay. Because as a reader.
No, it was just one of those great. It was just one of those great hunts. And I'll say this, man. We had a conversation this, you know, on this podcast, we had a conversation about, you know, like the way, how filming or writing affects the experience of right. hunting.
It does.
It's become inseparable for me now, though, because I've been gifted the ability to do things and go places and have experiences that I just simply would not have ever had were it not for, you know, writing and filming.
Yeah.
Because it just I simply wouldn't have had the money and time.
Yeah.
You know, I have, yeah, I got Lyme not filming. But I've had a lot of other problems, and like small problems, large problems, dangerous situations that in large part I just was egged into those situations somehow by my desire to hunt. Because I got friends that never stepped foot near filming and never stepped foot near writing. They get in all kinds of
right.
situations.
For sure.
But it does tend to, I'd be lying if I said, it does tend to add a second layer of motivation.
It does. I feel that.
To do things and stay out doing them because I almost wish it wasn't true, but it's true.
It is.
I may have watching my buddies, and I wasn't as experienced in the outdoors in 2004. I think it was to the 2004 hunt. Yeah, standing on that bank in a strange place in Alaska, watch my buddies say, like, see ya. And, like, there's, you know, you got grizzlies, saw a wolf right up from camp. It's like, yeah, there would have been a strong thing to be like, yeah, you know, it's just not the right year.
Yeah.
But I was like, no way, man, because as much as I'm a dedicated hunter, I guess I'm like a dedicated writer.
Yeah, and I've spent a lot of time in Alaska. I lucked out. My grandparents live there. I got three uncles who live there. And I go to some crazy places in Alaska. And the risks, just Alaska itself has inherent risks like no other place.
Yeah.
And then you are there alone. And anyone who has been on a free range bison hunt, like you and I have, and you tip one of them over, you walk up to it and say, what in the F am I going to do yeah. here? Seeing one at Yellowstone Park or seeing one at the, you know, the local bison farm does not do it justice to when that thing's laying on the ground, it's cold, you're wet, and all you have is a knife.
Yeah.
And you add all those together, and you did this in Alaska, I was just like, no freaking way.
The day I killed that one, I was camped on a ridge. It's like a ridge, but basically at the top of a canyon, like the plateau above a canyon, you know. Seemed like a ridge, but it actually didn't drop off the other side. But it snowed. I was sleeping under a little red tarp, red on top, silver on bottom. I had that tarp strung up, and I was actually burning buffalo chips because they had wallowed in that area in the summer. And I had a little mound of them stacked up under my thing. I just had a tarp, sleeping bag, buffalo chips, backpack. And woke up in the morning. It was all like wet snow had fallen. And I was going to start my alcohol stove to make some coffee. And I was like, well, I better take a look down in the canyon, you know, before I start my stove up. And I just grabbed my rifle and peered over it, and just like there was the freaking herd of them coming down, maybe because of the snow, just single file. And there's a big cow, and they're up toward the top, and it was wet snow. And I shot her with I'm left-handed. I shot her with a right-handed 300 mag I'd borrowed from a buddy of mine. And that thing started going down that wet snow. It's a long drop, a very steep pitch. And when it hit a stand of aspens or poplars, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it shattered. I mean, it was like a bowling ball hitting bowling pins, man, but just like smash and just stuff flying everywhere. And I went down, and that thing was so entangled in trees, I couldn't lift its head up.
Right.
I remember I just started, I was like, I'm just going to try to get a back leg off that thing.
Yeah.
And I eventually dragged the back leg away. And then I like cut a little gate to try to get some guts out of it. It was just it for 3 days.
Wow.
For 3 days, I cut and carried. And that didn't even get it down to where I needed to get it to. I cut and carried just to get it down to the tributary.
Wow. So of all of the crazy things that writing and filming has maybe pushed you a little further than you otherwise would have, you look back, is that one of the defining ones that you say, you know what, there's nothing else I could have done in my ordinary life that would have given me this experience, this sense of reward, this sense of accomplishment?
It was four trips that made... I guess there's four trips that made... I feel like you're interviewing me, Randy. But there's four trips that made...
I'm just curious.
Yeah, there's four trips that made me, like, when I think of, like, who I am, as a hunter, there's four trips that made me who I am. That's one of them. All four were in Alaska.
Okay.
The first was the first caribou hunt I went on the north slope of the Brooks Range. We just, like, pickup truck, canoes, me and my brothers, just... had no idea what we're getting into. The second was the first time we went on a very unsuccessful doll sheep hunt. Just park a truck, cross the river, start hiking. 9 days, saw one ram about 3 miles away that was sublegal. The third was a successful sheep hunt we went on where we killed two rams. Just self-guided, you know.
Yeah.
And then that buffalo hunt.
Wow.
Are the ones that, like, if I could give everything else, if I had to keep four and give the rest away, I'd keep those four.
Okay.
No doubt.
Well, I'll quit interviewing you. I'm overstepping here, but I'm just curious because now that I reflect back on having hunted for 38 years and tagged along with my grandfather and my dad even before that, I look back and there's just certain events that I'm like, you know what? No other activity that I could have done in my life outside of being a hunter would have exposed me to that, would have allowed me to walk away with that perspective, maybe that confidence, maybe pushed myself to that edge of saying, what the F am I doing here?
Yeah.
But then somehow being able to pull out of that, and I've not been in combat, so I'm not trying to equate hunting to what it's like to be having guys shoot at you or anything, but of hobbies and activities or passions in life, I can't think of anything that would have given me those experiences of, you know, I could probably list a handful of them like you do. And so now when you get to be 50, you reflect back on that and you're like, well, shit, am I just kind of out to pasture now? Am I done with those really cool experiences or... do I got more of them ahead of me? And you kind of get in this reflective mode at that point. And then you start interviewing the host of the show.
Because you feel like you're a statesman. Those challenges and tough things that happen to you and the discomfort and the like rewards and all that, that makes a special caliber of person. I like all manner of people. I hang out with all manner of people. But when it comes to like being comfortable around people in bad situations or like being comfortable around people in the outdoors, guys that have been through the military, mountaineers,
yep,
and big game hunters,
yep,
tend to be like people that I just like feel comfortable around, that I feel like reliable.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like when you're with people and there's people you got to take care of, and
yeah,
there's people that not only take care of themselves but take care of everybody else. I remember a guy talking about some people he fished with, and he said, "Steve, you got to wait in line just to wash a dish." Do you know what I mean? Meaning, like, the dudes he hangs out with, like, if you want to wash dishes, get in line, buddy. Everybody wants to wash them dishes. It's like that level of just, like, attacking problems.
Yeah.
You know, there's not many things in life that give. I'm sure there's more than I'm naming.
Yeah.
But lifetime exposure to those things seems to make the kind of guys that you got to get in line if you want to wash a dish.
Yeah. And maybe I'm biased because just about everyone I hang out with is a hunter. And so I can sit here and share these kind of experiences with them, and I can have this very, wow, yeah, I get that to its greatest detail. And when I'm in the field with them, I'm very comfortable around them. There's some people where if you gave them a butter knife, I'm so uncomfortable. I think this guy's going to figure out how to cut his thumb off with a butter knife.
Yeah.
You know, there's just some of those people where you're like, I got to get the hell out of here. I'm not going to have any fun if I'm with a guy like this. And usually they don't have the background of the three types that you mentioned, the military, the mountaineers, or big game hunters. And maybe there's a couple other similar.
Oh, sure, yeah, I'm sure there's more.
For me, it's just, yeah, that's why I asked the question of, you know, how profound that hunt was.
That's the situation I'm in now is, you know, I got kids, and my wife and I have this ongoing debate where I expose them to, I'm not negligent anyway, but I expose them to what might be regarded as dangers by a big segment of the population, right? To me, it seems like very pedestrian, not dangerous at all. But some people might regard activities that I expose my kid to, as being like not age appropriate or being a little bit dangerous. And I'm always like, yep, okay, that's a little bit dangerous. Sure, like he might cut his finger.
Right.
But the thing I always point out, we were having this conversation the other day. Someone's like, everybody keeps talking about my kid cutting his finger with his knife. I always cut my fingers with my knife when I was a kid. So it's like,
who didn't?
Like, one, how, like, let's not act like that's the end bad.
Yeah.
It's like, that's just a given. He's going to cut his finger. But I'm always like, okay, let's deprive him of the dangerous stuff. But at what danger does that come?
It comes at a huge danger, I think. Because
like later on, it's like you wind up with a helpless person. And there's other ways to get there. It's like, you know, I don't know if there's like some Bible passage, like there's many ways to get to whatever. There's other ways to get there. I'm not saying like if you don't hunt and fish with your kids, you're going to have crappy kids. Because it's certainly not the case.
No.
Because you can get there a bazillion ways.
Right.
But from my exposure, my experience, where I come from, the way to get there that I understand, the way to get there that I can present to my children is very much that way.
Yeah.
Because them watching me write isn't going to get them there.
True.
It's just not.
Yeah.
Them watching me record podcasts isn't going to get them there. Okay? Them watching me flay fish, it's hard to explain. I feel as though that might.
Really? My son felt a lot of danger when he'd see me balancing the debits and the credits.
He's like, Dad, the way you really handled that.
That abacus. You are the Charlie Daniels of the abacus, Dad. Man, I feel comforted now. You've taught me the life lessons. But
yeah. And it's a false, in some ways you might regard it as a false world now because in my mind, the nature of subsistence has changed for people to live anywhere outside of a small handful of locations around the world. The nature of like subsistence hunting and fishing, you know, it's just not like, like I always say, like, I'm going to eat fine, dude. You can take hunting and fishing away from me. I'm not going to tell you I'm going to starve.
Right.
You know, it's not like reality TV. It's like, if they don't get this, they'll die. Yeah. Right. It's just not true. But I guess I've just in some way opted that I believe in elements of that subsistence lifestyle, right, still pertain. And the main risk of imminent starvation isn't there, but there are tremendous risks of like character, fortitude,
understanding.
How to use stuff.
Yeah.
How to use physical objects.
Yeah. My son went to college back in New York, and I wondered, man, how is he going to fit in back there? You know, he's coming from Montana. All we did hunt, fish, you know, shoot, whatever, and he's going to an Ivy League school that's kind of, well, it's known to be not like Montana. And so I'm worried that, okay, he goes there. How's he going to fit in? How's he going to cope with the different environment? And the things he learned and the coping skills that he brought from hunting and fishing and understanding how a natural world works, he blew through it with no problem. I was so impressed with how adaptable so much of what he learned as a hunter, fisherman, shooting, cutting his finger with a knife when he's six, you know, shoot your eye out. I mean, he had a BB gun when he was like five.
Yep.
But he was in a whole group of people that were not exposed to that. And he kind of emerged from that, not just unscathed, but almost like a leader that they look to. Because
I think a lot of people would look at like the Woods upbringing and say, oh, they might miss out on some sort of social, you know, aspect that they're going to get more if you grow up in a big city like New York. But that's not the case. It's like you still have to have all those relationships and communicate with people and work through all that. And you're probably going to learn it because of the hardships in an even better way, in a stronger way, where like you're saying, he went there to that Ivy League school and people are like, wow, this dude like –
yeah,
he's strong.
And just his perspective of ability to look at a more complex problem and not need it to be sanitized down to little compartments of, you know, oh, well, this is a historical question. No, I think Hunter's, as a general rule, people who understand the natural world can stand back and look at a bigger, more complicated problem with multiple variables like you see in the natural world. And other people struggle with that.
Yeah.
And I didn't really give it much thought until watching him go through that process and watching some other kids, his friends, go through and do similar things in different places. And we'd have the discussions of, how are you fitting in there? Well, fine. What do you mean? You know, like, well, you're the one walking around with camouflage boots on an Ivy League campus and everyone else is, you know, whatever. You got your Mad Bomber beaver fur hat on and your chopper mitts. I don't care. I'm warm. You know, he was able to put everything in just a very simple solution, very pragmatic. And so this whole idea that we got to kind of coddle everybody, you know, back to your point of what is the future danger of removing all the dangers today.
Yeah.
I think we end up with kids or they become adults that can't handle a lot of things that maybe some of us just take for granted.
I remember being out with, I bought this sit on top kayak called a Big Tuna kayak, very stable sit on top fishing kayak. And I bought it very much in mind that I would fish with my boy. When we moved to Seattle, there's a lot of water around there. I just wanted something that I could get in the water. And the whole time, I'm like, sit on top. The whole time, I'm like, what if the kid falls in the water?
Yeah.
In the winter. And I was like, all my thinking was like, how he's going to not fall in the water. And we go out. And I got him bundled up. You know, he's got, obviously, I don't let the kid near a boat without a life jacket on.
Yeah.
We get out in the water. I mean, it's, you know, I don't know, January, February. Pacific Northwest, and he was offended, but I later accused him of just basically jumping out of the kayak. He just like all of a sudden he's in there and then he's in the water. He like it seemed to me like he did some kind of barrel roll out of his seat into the water. He fell very much. He did not want to be in that water. And like all of a sudden, like he's just there and then he's floating in the water.
Uh-oh.
You know. And I haul him out of there. And like at first, my mind's just racing, you know. One, the wrath of his mother.
Yeah. Oh, but, for sure.
I mean, I didn't have him out of the water 5 seconds. I was glad he fell in.
Yeah. Teach him.
So kind of like, one, falling out of the boat. Two, if a dude falls out of a boat in really cold weather, here's what you do. We're going to run through it right now so you understand like the situation we're in, right?
Yeah.
And, yeah, now I look at it like the one thing I didn't want to have was him falling out of the boat. Now when I think of, like, highlights of the last year, I'm like, man, it sounds perverse. I'm like, it was great when Jimmy fell out of that boat because, like, look how much content we got out of that.
Yeah.
Like, life's content.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow.
I mean, another time we were down in Baja fishing, and I went out in the dark to fish. And I told him 1,000 times, I'm like, stay here. Daddy's going to walk out in the dark. Don't move. You know, and I was going out to get a better cast. And I come up, somebody's just gone. And look, he's like rolling around the tide, and I reach out and grab him. And I just kind of like drag him up, throw him in the shower. My wife's like, what in the world? You know? But now I'm like, yeah, I guess I'm kind of glad. Because in some way I feel like it's adding layers onto him.
It is. I mean, I think about the stuff that I did. My parents would have been in jail. And we would have been in foster homes in today's world.
I mean, an actual endangered environment.
Yeah, in my podcast that we were talking about last week, me and my cousins tried to build a bomb to blow up the train bridge when we were 8 years old. I mean, You think about doing that now, but it's one of the, I learned
that's called
so much.
Son.
Yeah, I learned so much about how you can saw a shotgun shell in half and pull the wad out and dump the powder in a paint can. And I mean, and that if you didn't direct the force a certain direction, all they did was blow a scour hole out between the two railroad ties. I mean, but the stuff that we did was so valuable as I got older in life. And maybe it's because of the path I chose later in life, it was valuable. Maybe if I hadn't done all that stuff, I would have taken a different path. Yep. And people would have said, look at that knucklehead, grew up in that little town there. He doesn't know his ass from third base, but.
Or how to blow up a railroad bridge.
Right. But anyhow.
All right. So let's, you mentioned it. Plug it. You've been working on a podcast, deals largely in conservation issues. I'll let you tell me.
Yeah. And it's thanks to your friends here at 0.0. We were on a bear hunt last year. Giannis and Dan were filming me, and we talked about all kinds of things in the
rain. That's Giannis of Hunt to Eat t-shirt infamy, right?
There you go. What do you call him? The Latvian
lover?
Yeah, that Giannis.
Great t-shirt and magnate, Hunt to Eat. You got a Hunt to Eat t-shirt, Randy?
I do, thanks to Giannis.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you give it to him?
Yeah, he sent me two of them. Yeah. That good plug
but,
here. They're
but Yanni's not going to send you one. You got to go to hunteat.com and buy one of his t-shirts.
That's right.
And all right. So, yeah.
So, anyhow.
Dan and Giannis.
Yeah. They're like, you need a podcast, buddy. You're just like spouting off all the time. You're blowing and carrying on.
With no one there to listen.
Right. Yeah. You know, just nothing but a few seals and, you know, two poor camera guys. And so it took us the last part of a year to decide we're going to do this. And so thanks to these guys, we have the other podcast that 0.0 produces called Hunt Talk Radio, i.e. Randy Newberg Unfiltered. And it's just me and friends talking about hunting, fishing, growing up, conservation, a lot of politics, and probably we got into marital advice one time, didn't we? Mm-hmm.
We end these podcasts where you get to have a concluding thought.
Yeah,
give me some not that I need it, but okay. Give the listeners marital advice right. As you're concluding.
Okay,
I don't like to dictate your concluding thought.
No,
but if you see fit,
every camera guy I have is like in his 20s, early 30s. He's getting in this, you know, thinking of getting married. Like Dan, isn't Dan getting married this summer? All right.
Yeah.
And so they're all, I'm going to wear the pants in my house. And I just about drive in the ditch when I hear him say that. I'm like, yeah, right. And sooner or later, it's like, all right, you've been married 26 years, Randy. Give me one piece of advice. So this will be the concluding thought. Yeah,
I'm going to do marriage advice for mine.
Okay. Yeah. If you want a long, happy marriage, be more interested in peace than you are justice.
Ooh.
You don't have to be right. Being right is expensive, financially expensive, emotionally expensive, and you don't get to hunt and fish nearly as much as the guys who let them be right. More than half the time, they're right anyhow. So, yeah. You know what?
Chances are.
Yeah, it's not about this whole idea of justice. I'm right, she's wrong.
You'll regret saying that. Yeah. I proved to you that I actually was.
I mean, anyone who's been married more than about a month has been down that path. Yeah, and so I just tell everyone, be more interested in peace than you are justice, and all will be well.
I have three pieces of marital advice.
Okay.
Try to do them quick. Set a very strong precedent. When you meet a man or a lady, live the life that you want to live 10 years into your marriage.
Great advice.
Now.
Great
you
advice.
You will not earn back. You don't get freedoms.
Exactly. The noose doesn't get looser. It gets tighter.
I knew guys who would start dating a girl, and they're all infatuated. And, you know, it's like Thanksgiving at their parents and, you know, instead of doing whatever. And then a couple years down the road, they're like, well, you know, I actually usually on Thanksgiving, we usually fish steelhead around Thanksgiving. So we're kind of coming into the rivers. It's like, no, you don't. We go to my mom's every year for Thanksgiving.
Oh,
but yeah, well, I mean, normally it's like, live it, you know.
From the start.
Yeah. As much, you talk about dragging yourself away from mama. Drag, even at its most difficult point. At its most difficult point in the beginning, find it in yourself to drag yourself away from mama. Second piece of marital advice I have is
Wait, how long have you been married to you?
My anniversary's coming up.
Well, I know. That mean 1 year?
No, I got married in 2008.
Okay, so you're 7 years into it.
Yeah, I'm giving advice not from like having weathered time. I'm just like,
okay,
just observations.
All right.
You always hear it's like cliche, pick your battles.
Oh, for sure.
It's like there's just some stuff, like for instance, issues with my kids, like what they're doing when, who's going where for holidays. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like what their clothes are. Like what time we're supposed to get up or what time they got to be, just like, okay.
Yeah, that's just static. Ignore
just
this.
Like, and I'm not saying like just the kids, but there's many issues, like many matters of how our house is structured, how our time is structured, matters of our social life. Okay, there's just a lot of stuff like when you're going to be working, when you're not going to be working. Then I'm just like, okay, you know, we're going to be moving. Okay, so like the house we're going to live in. I know I have some input on this, but not a ton.
Right. Drum rolls. Number three.
Number three? How can I not remember number three? Oh, read the works of Cormac McCarthy. He never talks about marriage. But read the works of Cormac McCarthy and try to decipher his moral code, which is consistent throughout his works. And then and read them and internalize Cormac McCarthy's moral code, and you'll have a better marriage.
Huh. I'll have to read that.
Yeah, you're making a huge commitment for yourself.
Am I? It's not a picture book?
No. Well, she's wrote many books, but start with the Border Trilogy.
Oh, no.
And I'll sum them up the way I've interpreted the works.
Cormac okay, McCarthy. Please.
There's a morality there where a lot of people want to live in a world that existed before they made the decisions that they've made.
Okay. Yeah.
You go like, oh, but you're still trying. It's like, I see it all the time now after reading Cormac McCarthy. I'm like, oh, no, buddy. You're trying to live the life that existed before you made a very willful decision to take a certain path here.
Yeah.
Abandon the notion that you, like, abandon the idea that you're somehow going to get out of the situation you're in, kids, whatever. It's like, you're here now. There is no life outside of this. Stop pretending that there is.
Yeah.
Yanni?
Yanni, how long you been married?
You can have a concluding thought. It doesn't have to be about marriage.
No, I'll give one about marriage, I think. 12 years.
Okay.
2003. So I got a couple under my belt. They've all been great. This piece of advice actually came from another fishing client of mine. I think I guided her a few times.
Her,
yeah. And she'd been in a long, long marriage, and she basically got dumped for the secretary, or something along those lines. And
not the fishing guide.
Not the fishing guide. She didn't. She didn't see it coming, and it really beat her up. And so she went on. She embarked on this. You know, like it was a pole, but it was like a journey. But it was like this pole that she constantly kept up with, and she kept tallies and notes. And when she saw old couples, she always went to them and said, "Hey, what's the secret? What's your one little tip or whatever?" And what she came away from with it all, the number one word that people always said, and everybody's like, "Oh, it's love." You know, it's like, well, love is bullshit, you know, a lot of times. Love just does not have that lasting power sometimes. But what does is commitment. And yeah. I always try to remember that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm committed, you know, and I believe, and I have to believe that my wife is also committed to me. And that always, you know, no problems getting through hard times.
Ronnie Bain, who has no shortage of wise observations, was talking to an old man one time that was speaking of his wife. And the old man said, "You know, Ron, I wouldn't give you 10 cents for another one just like her, but I wouldn't take $1 million for her." And there's sort of a fatalistic sort of thing there.
Yeah.
It's just like, that's what I got.
Yeah. You know, well, I think any of us who get to hunt, travel as much as we do, got to have something figured out. And I think that's why a lot of people ask me for marital advice. I'm giving an elk hunting seminar and someone will raise their hand. How does your wife let you hunt so much?
Yeah.
And so I feel like I'm going into this Dr. Phil discussion or something. And I told him the best deal I ever made in my marriage was when we built our last house in 2004. I told my wife, you can take 15% of the cost of the house and add it to furnishings. Whatever you want. I don't care. I don't care what color, what size, but I never want to hear a budget discussion about hunting ever again.
Yeah.
And she jumped on that like a rat on a Cheeto, man. She was on it.
Yeah.
And so I hunt. I fish.
No, I get to hunt a lot. But here's the thing, though. I love being married. Like,
oh, me too.
Yeah. I love seeing my wife. I love being married. Yeah. I love having my kids. I like to hunt and fish.
Yeah.
It's like, so yeah, there's, and I'm not saying that everything that I'm arguing is on behalf of being able to hunt and fish more.
Yeah.
But I think that, like we were saying earlier, there's certain lessons to be found in hunting and fishing. And there's certain things where, you know, that's just like something that's important to me. And I've found a way to have it be that it's just like an integral part of the household, even though my wife, you know, familiar with, sympathetic towards, but would never, doesn't self-identify as an avid angler.
Yeah.
You know, doesn't hunt. Like, well, certainly fish, but doesn't. If you got the list 10 things she is, fisherwoman wouldn't make the list.
You know? Oh, gosh. I'm sorry to keep adding tangential discussions here.
Everybody's had their concluding thoughts.
Yeah, we gotta wrap it up.
This is the longest we've talked. This is the longest we've ever had to actually talk.
Oh, really, man? I'm sorry.
No. I mean, you and me.
Oh, yeah. You and I, we had a long phone conversation one time.
Never this long.
I remember. But, yeah, it's good. Hopefully, we'll get to do it over campfire and a fresh backstrap someday.
Yeah, well, we're all sick from something.
Yeah, I don't know. You guys come down with more foodborne ailments. I was telling my wife about some of the things you guys eat because she asked me what I was doing with that bear I shot this year, and I told them, oh, Giannis wants these hawks and this. She's like, aren't those the guys that get sick every time they cook something? I'm like, yeah. She's like, and you said you were going to go hunting with him sometime? Maybe. So,
yeah, you only eat anything that comes out of a package. But.
Yeah. Well, guys, thanks for having me.
No,
so
it was
much.
Great.
It's great. I appreciate all you guys do for hunting, and the message you guys are getting out there is so needed and so valuable. Not just to hunting, but how hunting can expand its boundaries to a bigger discussion in society.
So as usually I'll say like thanks for listening, but plug the podcast again.
Hunt Talk Podcast, Randy Newberg, Unfiltered. You can go to iTunes and get it. Produced by 0.0. Thanks for letting me plug it in, Steve.
Tune in. Thanks, everybody.
Appreciate it.